You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Sixth Amendment of the Constitution guarantees that anyone charged with a crime has a right to a speedy and public trial. But few cases actually go to court nowadays, and instead, our criminal justice system has come to rely heavily on plea bargains. In a recent article headed "Innocence is Irrelevant," Atlantic Magazine contributing editor Emily Yaffe explains not only why courts have come to depend on this approach, but also how our system coerces the accused into taking plea bargains and the impact that has on their lives. Emily Yaffe joins us now. Welcome to our show.
Thanks so much.
Are plea bargains mentioned anywhere in the Constitution?
No. And there's very little jurisprudence on plea bargains. The Supreme Court really only in recent years has started even addressing this. They've kind of been stuck in the 18th century, giving all these protections to people at trial, but people aren't going to trials. But in the past few years, there have been a few cases where they have started to extend some protections, and Anthony Kennedy, in one ruling a few years ago, said plea bargains aren't an extension of the criminal justice system. They are the criminal justice system.
Was a Supreme Court case from 1970, Brady versus United States, the one that established language for what a plea bargain should be?
Well, it does give some basis for what the court thought the elements of a plea bargain should include. But it wasn't specifically, it ended up being interpreted as the court's approval for plea bargains. But when you read it now and see how plea bargains happen today, it's almost kind of sweetly naive. The court in that 1970 case assumes before someone takes a plea bargain, the state will have presented overwhelming evidence of guilt. The defendant will have a good lawyer who has weighed the case and the evidence, that the person will have time to, quote, intelligently make a decision as to whether taking the plea bargain or going to trial is a better option. And the underlying thought of this was, look, in some cases where the evidence is overwhelming, if the person takes a plea bargain and acknowledges guilt, the state gives some credit for that and you get a lesser sentence. Essentially, all those assumptions have been thrown out during the rise of mass incarceration and mass overcriminalization of behavior. And to process the number of people we need to process, we need plea bargains. We need them to be quick. We need them to be efficient. And as the title of the story says, innocence is not really the factor that we're weighing.
You bring up the problem of trial penalties. What are they?
This is when you're charged with a crime, as I say in the story, about 95%+ at the state and federal level of felonies are resolved through a plea bargain. It's close to 100% for misdemeanors. But in more serious cases, the trial penalty is if a defendant has the temerity to say, no, I want to take my case to trial, he or she will face at trial the absolute maximum charges. Obviously, most people are convicted. So you might be given a plea bargain of serve a year in jail and 2 years probation, or you want to go to trial, fine. You lose, you'll serve 30 years. So,
and prosecutors and lawyers will tell the defendant that that's an obvious risk.
Yes, because if you go to trial, the charges will be maximized. You know, there are many charges that have mandatory minimums. So, you know, it's take this deal or roll the dice and you will be sorry.
Now, when were plea bargains introduced into our justice system?
They're really a 19th century innovation. In colonial times, there weren't plea bargains. The people, the legal historians I spoke to said, you know, trials were, most of them were very brief. The jury kind of deliberated in public. Things moved quickly. There were no plea bargains. Rules of law and criminal procedure started to get more formalized, which meant trials took longer. So there was a big incentive to find a way to make them more efficient and, you know, to make the system move more efficiently. And so in the 19th century, you started to see the rise of the plea bargain.
And professional prosecutors and defendants hiring lawyers, which all slowed things down.
Right, right.
How many people are arrested annually in the United States?
Sorry?
How many people are arrested annually in the United States? I have a figure of 11 million in 2015.
Yes.
Is it going up?
It actually is going down a little bit, which is good. But think of the meaning of that number of arrests. Now, obviously, that does not mean 14 million people are convicted of something. Those are arrests. Many, many cases just fall away when they're presented to court. I actually have a scene in my story. I spent a week in Nashville observing the criminal justice system, and I sat in with a prosecutor and two public defenders as they went through the night shift of people who've been arrested and were now in jail for various crimes. Almost all of these people were homeless people. And the prosecutor just, you know, someone was walking late at night, someone was sleeping on a bench, whatever, and the prosecutor just very quickly, within seconds, dismissed many of these cases. So of those 14 million arrests, many go away.
But many of them wind up, of the 630,000 people in jail on any given day, 70% of those are in pretrial detention.
Exactly. Yes. But many of the, but of the cases that move forward, almost all end with a plea bargain. Now, that number you mentioned, it is true. Most people waiting in jail are, I mean, you use the phrase pre-trial detention, which is almost comical, because they're not going to go to trial. Poor people who are arrested and can't make bail, which is often the case, end up sitting in jail awaiting the charges, awaiting facing the charges.
And I would think that that would be an incentive for them to take the plea as well, because they want to get out of jail.
You are thinking right. One of the public defenders I spoke to told me when she goes and sees her jailed clients. Now, some of them are innocent. And she said, look, you know, I can, if we do a little investigation, I can make a case to the prosecutor that, you know, you weren't trespassing, you weren't doing this or that. And they all look at her and say, get me out now. As she said, these are people in a cage. Every minute you spend in jail, you are more likely to lose your job. No one's taking care of your kids. The incentive to say, I did it, get a conviction, for a lot of misdemeanors, you know, time served will be all you'll get. So people, poor people, pile up convictions just because of that.
I'm speaking with Emily Yaffe, whose article in The Atlantic is Innocence is Irrelevant. And we have an interesting call coming in from Tom from Seabright, New Jersey. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I can't agree with your guests more. I was a public defender in, you know, inner cities in Roxbury and Boston, Camden, New Jersey, and Freehold in Monmouth County in New Jersey. And, you know, I'm sure she knows that, you know, we have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the prison population. It's a carceral state we have. You know, the plea bargains aren't good. They do coerce people to take the plea because they will get a worse outcome if they go to trial. The point is that most of the people the police arrest won't win at trial. They, you know, the police sweep through poor areas. They take people off the street. They find drugs on them. They see them, you know, selling drugs. They stop cars. They run their license plates. They search the cars. There's warrants. They find drugs or a weapon. It's very difficult to win. So plea bargains is one part of it, but the system, the discretionary extended terms, the mandatory extended terms, the long prison sentences, you know, it seems that my experience is the state is set up to put the most people who are likely to rebel against the system, because they're mainly poor, put them in jail through most of the productive years of their life.
But, Tom, wouldn't someone who decides to go to trial do that because he or she thinks that they're not guilty?
Well, you know, I probably defended, you know, I had maybe 10,000 clients over the years, and there's a few, like, the ones who might be innocent, totally innocent, they're and that's a term of art. They're weeded out of the system early. They're given pretrial intervention, or their case is dismissed, or it's a disorderly person's offense. But when they get indicted in New Jersey, now it's usually a police witness, a professional witness who has close contacts with the prosecutors. Their testimony is always strong and persuasive. The public defender usually isn't trained enough or has enough resources to combat that. So with the way the law is, if a defendant wants to go to trial and he has a criminal history, if he testifies, his criminal history will most likely come in to impeach his credibility. So there's so many things that prevent you, other than having a better plea deal in some ways than if you went to trial. But if you went to trial, most of the people that get indicted in New Jersey would probably be convicted, because now I'm sure the police lie many times, but the jury is not going to believe that, and they're not, and you couldn't really impeach them that way anyway. You'd have to have evidence that they've lied before, and that's very difficult to get with the staff that the public defenders have, and the funding is low. So it's a very difficult thing, and people that go to jail.
And Tom,
Just
one more thing. How many cases were you handling at the same time? Because Emily writes about that.
Well, and that's one of the reasons I got out of it. It almost killed me. You know, I took it very seriously. And, you know, probably 600, and that's per year, indictable offenses in Jersey. That's far more than any of the organizations that regulate that or make suggestions, the National Associated Defense Attorneys or Public Defenders. I forget the title. But it should be a quarter of that.
Emily, you want to jump in here?
What Tom is saying reflected what I heard from the many public defenders I spoke to. And he also is hitting on a really important point about poor people, what they get picked up for, you know, drug possession or using drugs. There's very strong evidence that, for example, black people and white people use marijuana at the same rates. But white kids smoke it in the family's basement or whatever. Poor kids are out on the street where you're vulnerable to being arrested. So a lot of, you know, I'm making a distinction between serious crime and the kind of repetitive arrests a lot of poor people are subject to. I spoke to public defenders, and they talked about their, quote, favorite reasons for arresting people. And one public defender told me that he gets these cases where people have been arrested for resisting arrest, but there's no underlying charge. So think about that. Somehow you encountered a police officer. You're not charged with anything beyond your encounter with the police officer was unpleasant, so then you're charged with resisting arrest.
Am I still on the air?
Yeah, and we're going to go to a break in a moment. But, Tom, what else do you want to tell us?
Well, you know, I was going to just follow up on what your guest just said. You know, I've read so many police reports where the police, they say, stop resisting, stop resisting. I think they're trained to do that. So just pulling away from a police officer's touch would be resisting arrest. And it's... It's very difficult to win. You know, most of the cases that go to jail are drug-related. The Fourth Amendment is being weakened and weakened each time the Supreme Court comes. So there's so many exceptions to unreasonable search and seizures that, you know, it's hard to win. And I tried to fight almost every case I had. And most of it came down to whether you had a good Fourth Amendment issue to suppress the drugs or whatever they found in the car. And if you lost that, then you got a worse plea offer. I wanted trial cases, and it was very hard to get them, because if you didn't went to trial, I was almost certain we were going to lose 95% of the time, and he would get or she would get a worse sentence. So, you know, the police aren't set up to catch people on Wall Street. They don't get white-collar criminals. They drive through poor areas. They pull over poor people. Chances are they don't have a license. They might have drugs. They usually do have drugs. You know, the cases they come to us. You know, when they stop someone, they don't have drugs. They let them go. You know, and so there are many reasons why we have the highest prison population in the world, and also the longest terms too. We have a very, very punitive system. There's not much rehabilitation. So
we have to take a little break here. But Tom, thank you so much for calling us.
Well, thank you.
And we will be back with more with Emily Yaffe. Her article in the current issue of The Atlantic is Innocence is Irrelevant. We're back with Emily Yaffe. Her article in the current issue of Atlantic is Innocence is Irrelevant. We're talking about plea deals. Don't about 65 million Americans have a criminal record? That's, what, 65 million over a little over 300 million?
Isn't that amazing? Some of the numbers I stumbled upon while doing this story just astounded me. And what we really haven't grappled with as a society is when you have a conviction, even if it's for a relatively trivial thing, as obviously most of these are, we don't have 65 million hardcore felons who served hard time. This conviction can have lifetime consequences in ways we don't even know or study. When you apply for a job, for example, you get asked, have you ever been convicted of a crime? If you say yes, you don't know you didn't get the call back because of that conviction. But these things really can haunt people, can affect ability to get student loans, housing, certain professional licenses. You can be barred from getting a cosmetology license, depending on the kind of conviction you have. So we, as your caller, Tom, the public defender, was talking about, we are an extremely punitive society, and we really don't think about the consequences of being this punitive. I mean, we convict so many people that we prevent, I mean, 65 million is stunning. Many people from leading normal, productive lives.
How many of them how much of that figure is the result of plea bargains? Do we know?
Almost all.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you see that on the federal and state level, 95%+ of convictions are the result of pleas, and for felonies and in the misdemeanor realm, it's even more. I don't know how you get much more than that. It's overwhelmingly plea bargains.
In some of the cases,
I think we have an artificial sense of how many trials there are, because trials get covered in the news. Sensational trials get covered, and the things that go to trial tend to be the dramatic, sensational case. A lot of people have been called for jury duty. I just read a story that said, in fact, very few Americans end up getting called for jury duty. Leonard, maybe you have the same experience that I do. I get called for jury duty all the time.
I've been called a number of times, but not recently, and I appreciate that.
So most most people don't even have the experience of being called for jury duty. But if you do, you think, okay, this is how the system works. It's not how, trials are not how the system works.
I'm wondering about some of the reasons people are arrested. For example, you heard of one case where a woman was arrested for walking down the road at around 1:30 in the morning. Right. What would she have been charged with?
That's a good question. On the, you know, maybe a disorderly conduct or something. These were the homeless cases. As I said, I sat in on the morning meeting of going through the overnight arrests, and almost all of these were homeless people. So, yes, there was a woman there who was charged with walking down the street at 1:30 in the morning, and the police report, she had no, you know, when asked what she was doing, she gave no legitimate reason.
And you say that the police have wide discretion in deciding whether or not a person is breaking the law.
Right. And this, again, this is really, we're looking in the realm of poverty. I mean, so much of the arrests are a result of poverty, mental illness, homelessness, addiction. We, as a society, kind of toss all our problems into the criminal justice system and try to sort them out there, which is obviously the worst possible place to do it. The number of mentally ill people who get arrested and get put through the criminal justice system is amazing. I talked to public defenders in Nashville, where I did most of my reporting, and you know, they said they have these family members. You have a severely mentally ill loved one who's not on medication, who you worried about, and who do you call? You call the police not to get this person arrested, but to get this person some help. But they end up getting arrested. And one thing that became really clear is that if we took a lot of the money we spend on criminal justice and try to deal with, and I know these problems are intractable, addiction, mental illness, homelessness, in a more therapeutic way, we would have to arrest fewer people. These aren't easy solutions, but racking up convictions is not a good solution either for poverty or addiction or mental illness.
Emily Yaffe's article in the current issue of Atlantic Magazine is called Innocence is Irrelevant. It's all about plea bargains. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You write that when you were in Nashville, you were struck by how many people were in court because they had been driving without a suspended license. Don't states suspend licenses for a number of reasons, like not paying traffic fines or not paying child support, not just the obvious ones?
Well, yes, in my naivete, I thought people got their license suspended because they were dangerous and they shouldn't be on the road. Most of the people in the lowest level, when you go through the court, you know, the people with felonies go in a certain courtroom. There's a what's called in Nashville a general sessions court, and these are the lowest level felonies. Almost all of them, the vast majority were suspended license cases. There are, you know, quite a few drug cases. This is an insane system. To make money, Nashville's not alone. A lot of states suspend licenses, not just for unpaid traffic tickets, for example, but because you're behind in child support, for example, or you have a previous unpaid court cost. Poor people, each time you get arrested and go through the system, you accrue court costs, which is another thing that those of us who are lucky not to have gone through this system don't really know about. So there are, as a money-making project, states suspend the licenses of people who owe money, and of course, in America, it's very hard, not in New York, but the rest of the country, hard to function without a car. So that's supposed to be an incentive for you to pay off your fines. Well, what happens is if you're behind in child support or whatever, Then you have a suspended license, so you're driving to work on the suspended license. You get picked up again, and you know, you either make the choice, I can't get to work, I lose my job, or you drive illegally and you get picked up over and over again.
And now you're a hardened criminal.
Well, the system is perfectly designed to prevent the results it's seeking. It's trying to get people to pay their fines and, you know, be better functioning citizens, and it destroys that chance. The DA in Nashville, who's responsible for enforcing this state law, said to me he's adamantly opposed to it. It's absolutely crazy. I talked to, this isn't in the story, but I talked to a father of three, middle-aged man with a job, no other conviction record except for suspended license. He's divorced. He once got in arrears on his child support. He's currently up to date, but he hasn't been able to pay off the $1,500 that he still owes. So he has gotten picked up on a suspended license probably eight times.
Let's take another call. Anthony from Greenberg, New Jersey, you're on the air.
Yeah, I was 45 years old at the time, and I got arrested in Washington Heights where a cop, they rushed the corner. I was coming out of the store. The cop picked up the cocaine, put it on me. I got arrested, got indicted by the county. And when I went to court, Judge Bud Goodman, I'll never forget this man, Judge Bud Goodman told me that if I took this case to trial, I was going to get 15 years. So I better plead this case, or he's going to be my trial judge, which seems to be impossible that a hearing judge is going to be a trial judge. And the fact that I never had been arrested before, and I had to take and he would not let me plead in the Bronx. I learned that I would have pled to a misdemeanor, a misdemeanor. I have a felony conviction now because of that. But thank God I was still able to go to because I was a recovering addict. So I was able to go to college still. But I lost my job because they suspended my license even after it was over for 6 months, and I had to pay $550 in court costs plus a New York State cost of $25. That's ridiculous. Now, if I didn't have family, I'd still be paying that.
Now,
and that's in New York.
Emily, are situations pretty much the same around the country, or is this an extreme case? Anthony suggests that the Bronx would have had an easier time in the Bronx.
I got picked up. They did it to another guy. When they rushed the block, the people that had the drugs on them threw them down, and the cops picked it up and gave it to me, and they gave it to this young Dominican kid who couldn't speak English. And I'm telling you, man, I had to take this because my lawyer told me, he said, what jury is going to believe you over this officer?
Emily?
From my research, what he's saying is absolutely the case around the country. Look, public defenders, they are overworked, underpaid. They have huge caseloads. There's a phrase, they talk about meet them, greet them, and plead them. Not that public defenders don't want to defend their clients, but they can't. And what Anthony's describing, who is going to say to a client, go to trial, lose, and serve 15 years, or plead to whatever's being offered and do minimal time or be on probation, et cetera. But as Anthony mentioned, then you accrue fines. The pressure on people to take whatever plea is offered is enormous. And Anthony had a lawyer. Many people who are charged with low-level misdemeanors have no attorney. In these suspended license cases, they're just there by themselves. They have no idea of the consequences, often, of pleading guilty to various things. So many people go through the court system having never even met a lawyer.
Some states are trying to decriminalize some crimes. New York City recently made public drinking and public urination civil rather than criminal violations. But on the other hand, doesn't Attorney General Jeff Sessions say he wants federal prosecutors to use maximum possible charges for crimes and to enforce mandatory minimums? Does that mean harsher plea bargains?
Well, yeah. When you're charging the max and you've got mandatory minimums, again, that's that trial penalty. You cannot roll the dice and say, I want to exercise my constitutional right to a trial. You will likely lose a trial and then face a penalty so disproportionate to what you would have gotten in a plea bargain. But, Leonard, you put your finger on something that's this interesting dichotomy we're experiencing now. There is, on the right and left, people are coming together and saying, okay, we've way overdone this. We put too many people in prison. We charge too many people with crimes. We've made too many things crimes. We got to roll this back. Across the country, red states and blue, and even within, you know, Texas, Houston, Texas, poor Houston right now, they just, Houston elected as its district attorney a Democratic woman who ran on a platform of rolling back some of these most serious penalties. So even though Donald Trump got elected and spouting law and order, at the same time we have seen in recent years district attorneys who come into office with the vow to start trying to unravel some of this and decriminalize, exactly as you said. New York had to settle some federal lawsuits brought during the Obama administration for its use of mass misdemeanors. And so it is taking things that used to be a criminal penalty and turning it into a civil penalty. Now, this doesn't mean there aren't behaviors that, you know, are problematic in society. You know, public urination, public drunkenness, those are problems. But giving people a criminal conviction for it is, you know, and just churning them through the criminal system is also not necessarily the best solution.
Just one more thing, because we're pretty much out of time. A listener wonders why Americans still persist with the bond system in Britain. They've moved away from it. And there is talk about getting rid of bail, but the Times had a big editorial dealing with it and said that the bail bondsmen have a very strong lobby and are fighting it like hell.
Well, yeah, that would put them out of business. As you, when we opened our conversation, you mentioned the hundreds of thousands of people sitting in jail every day, almost all of them awaiting to be processed through the system. They're there. They haven't been convicted of anything, but they can't afford to get out of jail. So we really do treat people with money and people without money differently, and
as Anthony pointed out earlier,
yes. And so the cruelty of and sometimes it's like people don't have the $500 or whatever to make bond. The cash bail system is something that really this country should take a hard look at, and the. Just the intrinsic unfairness of it.
Emily Yaffe is a contributing editor at The Atlantic. Her article in the current issue is Innocence is Irrelevant. Emily, thank you so much for being on our show.
Leonard, it was my pleasure. Thank you.